Hype Man, Raj Nation, the GOAT, GOAT to Market. From Hype HQ in Chicago, Illinois, Startup Hype Man presents the GOAT to Market Show. What's up, everyone? I am your host, Raj Nation, the founder and chief pitch artist of Startup Hype Man. This podcast is where we bring you founders, company leaders, and creatives who are building it, who are doing it, who have been there and done that. And they pull back the curtain on their go-to-market strategies so that you can build a venture that you love and become the GOAT of your industry. Want first listen on episodes before anyone else? Subscribe to our newsletter at startuphypeman.com. You will get alerts every Sunday morning when we release new episodes. All right, let's hear how today's guest is becoming the GOAT. What's up, everyone? It's Raj Nation, the Startup Hype Man here, coming to you with a special treat this week on the GOAT to Market show. Now, in addition to running Startup Hype Man, I also have the honor of being the chapter director for Startup Grind Chicago. Startup Grind is a global startup community with over 600 chapters around the world, and I run the Chicago chapter. Today on the GTM show, we're featuring my interview with Mike Lavatola live from Startup Grind Chicago's fourth annual Great Chicago Food Bash, an event that highlighted the local food and beverage startup scene. Mike is the co-founder and former CEO of Foxtrot. He recently stepped down from his position as CEO, but he led the company for about a decade from crazy idea for a boutique convenience store for millennials to a national brand that has raised over $200 million and most recently completed a successful merger with one of the most recognizable names in grocery, and that is Dom's Kitchen and Market. In this interview, Mike touches on the struggles to raise capital and convince people this is more than just a crazy idea. On top of that, he shares the importance of building a really strong brand experience, identifying areas of growth within your customer base, including this concept of spotting customer adjacencies that I think you're really going to like. And he also shares his opinion that data isn't everything, and sometimes gut is more important than data. So here we go. Enjoy my interview with the co-founder and former CEO of Foxtrot, Mike Lavatola, live from Startup Grind Chicago's Great Chicago Food Bash.
Hello, hello. We're cruising.
Yeah, all right. We're good. How's our like angle tilt towards each other? Good enough?
Yeah. I feel like we're good here.
Yeah. Sweet. Hey. Mike, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
A lot of people were super excited to have you here, or to get to hear your story and everything like that. So we're gonna walk it back, and we're gonna go in the Wayback Machine. We're gonna talk about the Foxtrot journey, your story, all that stuff. Let's start with, you know, earlier when you got here, we were just talking for a minute, and I didn't know this, but you are one of six siblings, is it?
Six boys. They really wanted a girl, and they got six of us. So
you got a boys starting basketball team and the sixth man. As the oldest of six siblings, what do you feel like your family dynamic kind of has taught you as you now are an adult in the operating in the world?
I think operating through chaos is probably a good one. Taking ownership and responsibility, right? Like, you're the oldest of six, you know, our parents love us, our house was very, very fun, but, you know, there's only so much time to go around. So if you want to get something done, it's on you. Like, no one's going to do it for you. And I think that mentality has hopefully been helpful in building a company.
Now, in a run of siblings, it's actually not that common that the oldest would end up in entrepreneurship. Usually the oldest goes like the safest route, and then the middle or the younger, you know, has a chance to screw up, basically. Did you feel like an extra burden on your shoulders or a weight on your shoulders?
I was doing really good on the safe route, like really good. I had no intention of starting a company. This is way too hard. So, you know, I was, I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, ended up at Illinois for undergrad, which was great. Ended up down in Austin, Texas, doing investment banking, back up here, doing private equity. So just like standard stuff. I ended up getting into University of Chicago for business school, which I was like ecstatic about. I couldn't believe it. So I moved back up here for that, and had every intention of, you know, going back into finance and buying widget manufacturers and whatever, and then somehow took a really hard left turn into convenience stores. So I am as surprised as anyone. My parents were like, what the fuck is going on here? This is like not what we had planned. But you know, I think there's some lessons in that too. Like entrepreneurship is really, 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 really hard. Starting a company is really, really, really hard. And so, you know, you have to have a ton of conviction in what you're doing to actually put yourself out there and making it happen. So kudos to everyone here for you know, being on that journey. I mean, I've had, you know, so many friends over there who have companies and a few more that I've gotten to meet tonight. And, you know, it really is just putting one foot in front of the other. And to get to this stage where you have a product and you are able to sample it to people and talk about it, like, that's a huge, 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 huge step.
Make some noise for everyone again who is demoing, right? So, you know, you said you made that left turn into convenience stores. I'm curious, you know, your co-founder, Taylor Bloom, and you, like, were you just like, you know, growing up, you're like, I love 7-Eleven and I want to build this. Like, who picks convenience store?
25-year-olds who are in certain states. No, it was one of those things like, you know, again, I was fortunate. I was living in Austin, which is this amazing city in terms of food and beverage. So, you know, there's crazy things. This is a decade ago. So it was all about craft beer. You know, the coffee scene was crazy. There were these bakeries everywhere. I moved back to Chicago, same deal. And meanwhile, on the coast, I've always been really, really, really into brands. And so there's so much interesting stuff happening in CPG more broadly. And then locally on the chef side, like there was just so much energy and action around that. And then conversely, like no matter where I moved in the city, it didn't matter what neighborhood I was in, I was just like living next to the same, you know, really crummy 7-Eleven, for lack of a better word, right? And it's like, well, how can there be all this excitement in essentially every neighborhood in the city, but the thing that's serving these communities, it's this kind of like drab, depressing place filled with products that don't like at all resonate to what, you know, me, my friends, and others were into. And so the idea was, you know, these guys are smart, meaning 7-Eleven or whoever. They know sort of which categories like make a convenience store. So let's not reinvent the wheel there. But we can go in and re-merchandise that with all the stuff that we're obsessed with, right? So my friend is making this crazy coffee. These guys are making the best beer. Did you have that donut? Like, did you hear about that one place in Brooklyn that's making this crazy sauce? And like kind of turn convenience from this place that of just like, you know, kind of lowest common denominator product to like a celebration of what's out there. And so that was very much the sort of inspiration for starting it.
Can you hand me that system seltzer that's there? Sorry. My mouth's quite dry. Just system seltzers. The system works. Are you parched? Would you like a seltzer? Would you like a cocktail? Maybe an affogato?
I am good. Thank you so much. As soon as I finish, I'm getting more of the host because that stuff is the real deal.
Okay, so you're bringing a lot of stuff together. And you're going into a hyper entrenched market, right? Like 7-Eleven's been around for years. For those who are old enough to remember White Hen, remember they were the biggest competitor and then 7-Eleven bought them out. When you're initially trying to raise capital for this, are you talking to investors and are you saying like, we're going up against 7-Eleven? Like how are you able to even convince them in the first place? It's a radical idea.
I couldn't. I mean, I was horrible at fundraising. I mean, like really bad. Like I don't know how far you want to skip ahead, but like we couldn't, I mean, for the first 4 years, I couldn't raise money. And like by not raising money, I mean like, you know, really couldn't raise money for like 2 or 3 years. And then it was like $50,000 checks at a time. And, you know, so never had more than like 4 months of runway, not paying. It's like, you know, just a total mess. So the good part about that is you have to have a ton of conviction in what you're doing to keep going, because otherwise you're like, you know, I mean, it like really makes you go crazy. But that like, you know, going up to bat, like every day being told no every day is, you know, probably not good for you. But it, you know, did ask, you know, myself, my co-founder, a lot of hard questions, like, why are we doing this? Like, are we crazy? Like, what is going on here? And so what we always went back to was, you know, the data, right? And so it's like, all right, well, this knucklehead who doesn't know what we're talking about says no, but he doesn't know what he's talking about anyway. Meanwhile, like I know how to like read our cohort data, right? And we had, you know, like 80% revenue retention 2 years out. Like who has that, right? And so when customers found out about Foxtrot, they would come back, they would come back more often. And more importantly, what they were coming back for was the really specific parts of why we started it, right? So like, I always carried Diet Coke and Oreos because like, no one's made a better Oreo than Oreos so far. And people bought them, but what they were really coming for was like really cool, interesting wine, or like, you know, some ice cream that you couldn't get anywhere else, or some local cookie that I was obsessed with. And so what was driving baskets and what was driving that cohort behavior was like the really specific stuff that we were doing that we had a unique take on that no one else was doing. And so like, for sure, if we didn't, like if our data said something different, we would have stopped because, you know, you like running into a wall is not good for anyone. But we just had conviction that like at a certain point, this thing was gonna have to turn.
Did you, so you mentioned it was a rough journey. Did you have a moment where you were like, you wanted to give up or you were like about to?
Yes, years, I mean, constantly. Yeah, no, totally, it's awful. I mean, like, think about it. So, you know, I was super fortunate that I got into this like, I was so excited to get into school. I'm like, my God, this is amazing. I can go do whatever I want now. And then, you know, I ended up passing up my, you know, fancy offer to go start this company, which is like kind of crazy, but it was like, you know, sort of working. And then, you know, it's like all fun and games for the first like year, but now it's, you have a ton of debt. You have no money. I mean, everyone's in a different situation, right? But like, you have a ton of debt, you have no money. All your friends are now in these like very fancy jobs, killing it. And you're like, you know, hanging out in a random convenience store in Lincoln Park at 10 o'clock at night bagging groceries. Like, you're like, I don't know if this was a good idea. There was a lot of moments like that. It's funny now, but it was super not funny then. So I'm happy I started it young. But like in all seriousness, yes. And I'd say there was no way that we, that I would have kept doing it, that I would have gotten anywhere if I didn't have my co-founder, Taylor. So, you know, he was our CTO, is our CTO. And, you know, we went in it together, and it was one of those things, you know, that he trusted me completely on the brand side, on the, what is, like, essentially what is Foxtrot and making that happen. I had trusted him completely on everything technical, and, you know, now everyone knows the stores, but when we first started, for the first 3 years, there was no stores. It was all online. The whole thing was about delivery. That was kind of the novel, interesting thing at the time. And it was one of those things like, you know, like no one else gets what you're going through when you're doing it. And so if I didn't have him, there's like no chance I would have kept going.
I didn't know that the start of it was just delivery, because I think I probably like started, you know, becoming a customer of the brand in the last like 3-4 years, mm-hmm. I'd say. But it sounds like, you know, you had a pretty methodical approach about this. You weren't trying to do everything at the same time. You were like, there's a clear order. Can you kind of walk us through like the timeline of where you started to how it
grew? The first version of the company, again, this is like 10 years ago. So this is like, I think Instacart had like just started that year, like Postmates like maybe had just started. But, you know, the kind of conceptual thing behind it was like convenience we saw was like the last big category to come online, right? So Seamless is big and Grubhub is big and they're doing crazy, crazy volumes. But for everything that's not a meal, none of that stuff was getting delivered, right? And meanwhile, convenience is like a $700 billion or some crazy number market, right? And so we're like, you know, if people are getting all these meals delivered, there's no reason why they shouldn't be getting, you know, like ice cream and wine and all these other things delivered. And at first I thought it was, there was some legal reason behind it, like you couldn't deliver wine, you couldn't deliver beer. And it was one of those things where like, it wasn't explicitly not legal, you know? It just kind of like was nothing. So we took that and ran with it. And, you know, we were very, very asset light, right? We had no, so, you know, Tay built the tech. And I made the joke about the random convenience store in Lincoln Park. It's like literally what it was. It was like, you know, a place called Milk and More. It was fun. And so like orders, you know, customers always thought it was coming from us. Our value was really about the brand and the curation and surfacing these things. But when the order went through, someone or us at the convenience store would like bag it up. Another local delivery company would come deliver it. And we were just this like thing in the middle, right? And like, so that was great because we could sort of prove out the thesis, prove out, you know, a lot of what we wanted it to be. But ultimately, like the value of Foxtrot wasn't the curation, wasn't finding these cool new products. And so when I tried to get them to carry stuff that I wanted, like he's like, dude, I'm not like trying to, like you can keep buying stuff here, but like this isn't like a partnership kind of thing. I was like, all right, well, if I'm going to scale this up, like I got to get a hold of my own inventory. one, to carry the products, but two, to make any real, you know, margin off this thing. Like, we couldn't raise any money, so we had to, like, make a profit. And so that was, you know, kind of very much the journey.
I think then, so as you started to, like, gather, you know, there are so many up-and-coming brands at Foxtrot. As you started to, like, have those conversations, we often think in the startup game, like, the importance of convincing investors, but I have to imagine in this case, just if not more important, was trying to convince these, like, partner brands to take a gamble on placing their brand in your hands, right?
Totally. Like, so it was like, now it's, you know, a bit of the inverse, but for the first, like, no one knew who the hell we were because we were nothing. Also, we were in Chicago, and also none of this stuff got sold online, right? So, like, I, you know, we were the, it's a random example, but, like, we were the first, you know, partner for Harry's, like the shaving company, right? So, like, why is that important? Because they had a really big following with guys who, of a certain, you know, who would spend money on, like, cool whiskeys and beers, right? And so, you know, we would carry brands like that because then they would email their customer base, like, hey, you can now get your Harry's razor delivered in under an hour. And that was our customer acquisition. And so it was very much one of those things, like, you know, you totally have to fake it till you make it. But if you can get, like, one or two of these really interesting, cool brands to say yes, and it's way easier to get the third and way easier to get the fourth, right? And then you kind of become this thing where it's like, well, actually, people are calling you to get on the shelf. So, yeah, but for those first, you know, however many years, it was very much us trying to convince them versus vice versa.
Sounds like then that, like, one of the keys was finding, like, the adjacency in what the customer would want. Like, a Harry's razor means a consumer who wants this style of whiskey and this something else, and that, as you went to other brands, were you thinking about it in that same sort of strategic way?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, Foxtrot is a brand. Like, that's what, you know, we've gone from a under an hour convenience delivery service to essentially, you know, 40% of our business right now is coffee, or 35 or something, right? Don't quote me on that. But, like, big percentages, right? So how can you move from something that seems so disparate? It's having a really, really, really strong brand, and that takes, you know, that's design, that's creative, that's curation. It's really, it's really everything, right? So you have to be very, for a consumer brand anyway, really, 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 really intentional about that, because it does then allow you to flex into different spaces as you continue to grow.
This is not the mic, this is the drink. The system works. When you don't want it, you have it. Let's talk about the brand for a little bit. It has really become an iconic brand for anyone who interacts with it. How do you get the name Foxtrot, the logo? Talk us through. And what does brand mean to you, and what does it entail?
Yeah. So to me, like, brand isn't really the name or the logo. It is, like, just sort of the, I don't know, got to think of a better word than this, but, like, it's everything, right? Like, every decision you make is the brand. And actually, that's been a really hard thing in scaling the company. Like, at first, I didn't have to explain the brand. I knew what the brand was. It was this, not that, and, like, this is what we're doing. Like, who was I gonna explain it to? It was me and Taylor. You know, as you onboard people, and you onboard people who have much more experience than you, and are in they're great, and they're coming from other backgrounds, like, having to explain why we would carry you know, a certain product, but not another product that looks similar, but actually it's, like, totally, it's like hard to put those differences in there, but it's really, really, really important. And so we, you know, from a design perspective, even when we were very small, we always had a really specific take on design, which was helpful in the early days because it made us look way bigger than we were, which was really, really important. And from a customer standpoint, like, it also made customers, I think, more comfortable, like, using us and, like, giving us money to go bring them things, right? Like, when you don't look sketchy, people are down to buy $70 bottles of wine from you. Like, that's awesome. So that really had a lot to do with it. But, you know, then it became helpful in fundraising, and then it became helpful in recruiting because, you know, people want to work with brands that are interesting. As far as the name, I mean, you know, so when I started this, I was 20, I don't know, 5. Taylor was like 23, some sort of boy genius, graduated college at 20 kind of deal. And we were delivering beer and wine, and we really didn't want it to be this, like, bros delivering booze app. Like, that was never my vision for the company. And I knew, like, no matter what we did, people were going to think it's like, oh, there's these two really bro-y dudes delivering booze. So that being that, I'm like, nothing in the name could have anything to do with alcohol in it. Like, nothing should have to do with delivery. And it's got to be something that kind of, it's kind of, like, ambiguous enough to let us, like, morph into whatever the company's gonna become. And so someone's girlfriend at the time, now wife, suggested Foxtrot, and I kind of loved it because it was like, you know, at the time we're a delivery service, and a fox is like a swift moving animal that, you know, comes at you. I thought that was kind of cool. I thought we could get a cool logo out of it. And, you know, I thought if it became anything, you know, we'd change it. And of course, like now I love it, right? Like it's sort of singular. It feels really, really strong. It allows us to flex, and it kind of, you know, puts us, it's not confused for anything, which I think is really, really important.
And I think, too, one of the things you've achieved, which is very, very hard, like a very small percent of companies get here, but like it's become a verb as well as a noun, right? Like you can Uber something or you can Foxtrot it, right? It's not go on the Foxtrot app and order it. It's, oh, I Foxtrotted it. And that, I think, just give them a round of applause for just how like incredible that accomplishment is.
We'll be back with more of my interview with Mike Lavatola in just a moment. But first, I've got a message for you, friends. I want to talk to you about my new friends, and those are my friends at ActiveCampaign. Look, I'm going to be real with you. After about 10 years, I finally was able to get out of a long, abusive, toxic relationship with MailChimp. That's right, I dropped the chimp and I swapped it for the goat. ActiveCampaign is the goat of marketing automation because let me tell you this, whether you're a B2B SaaS, a marketplace, a consumer app, a services business like Startup Hype Man, or anything in between, every kind of business needs a newsletter. And from setup to send, every newsletter we have published has been a 10 times easier experience since switching to ActiveCampaign. They've got tons of integration, so hooking up anything I already have into ActiveCampaign is super easy. Automations are made simple. It's like a drag and drop interface. It's just like super easy to work with. And I think my favorite part is actually supportive customer support. I'm not sent through like a long ticketing system. There's not an annoying chatbot I have to deal with. All in all, I no longer feel restricted by my software. Not to mention, they make all the data migration from your previous provider so quick and easy. I honestly had to actually ask multiple times, what more am I supposed to be doing here? Because it was that painless and that hands off. I want you to experience this type of relationship. You might be in a toxic relationship right now with your current marketing automation system, or maybe you don't have one yet. Well, in either scenario, I want you to get the goat of marketing automation, and I want you to be in a blooming, healthy, and beautiful relationship. You can get your free 2-week trial by tapping on the link in this episode description. Back now to the interview.
And I want to know from the audience here, like, raise your hand if you've ever ordered wine from Foxtrot before. A lot of you. Raise your hand if you've ever had a coffee at Foxtrot. Even more. Have you ever ordered any of their cafe items, like their baked goods or their fresh meals? Anything off the shelf, like the packaged goods, yeah? And there's even some, you know, because there's some off-the-shelf things too, like adult toys are also sold through Foxtrot. Something like that, like when you're like, okay, we've got milk, we've got coffee, vibrator. How do you be like, we're gonna have that too?
It's part of the brand, right? Like the brand is about curation. It's about being fun and playful and knowing and, you know, sort of having like a wink there, right? Like it's a convenience store. Like convenience stores sell bongs and papers and all kinds of weird like pills and shit. So, you know, like that's not our game. But like when something like, you know, Maud comes out or Dame comes out, like it's a beautiful brand. They're like, you know, doing it in a really interesting way. They are really striking a chord with customers. Those customers are our customers. So like pair it with a bottle of wine and let's go. Like it's a really, really fun. And you know, like I also think things like that are, I'll stop talking about this in a minute, but like fundraising is really, 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 really hard. As all of you know, it's so hard and deals die at the last minute all the time. Like they just do. And we were trying to get our Series B together. We had no cash left, but it's like this great deal. And we got it together. And it was going to close on like the day after Valentine's Day. And I was just like running, you know, I was like, the one time I was like not in the weeds. So anyway, we launched that big Valentine's Day collection like the day before. And I'm like, oh my, it's like all of our press and comms were about all these fun toys. And I'm like, oh my God, if this thing backfires and our deal falls apart because of this, I'm going to be so screwed. But they didn't and they loved it. So, but no, I mean like if you're a young challenger brand, like you have to take calculated, it's not even a risk. You just have to know who you are and be confident about it.
So as a challenger brand, like if we look at Foxtrot, It is a delivery app. It is a retail storefront. It is a cafe. It's a, I mean, you could almost say it's like a co-working area to some extent, right? It's got packaged goods. It's got fresh goods. It's sometimes a pizzeria to some extent too, right? So with all of these things built into, and it's incredibly sophisticated technology on the back end that powers all of this. And we kind of started this with, oh, like there was 7-Eleven, and 7-Eleven operates in the category of convenience stores. Do you see Foxtrot in a different category, or is it in that category going right up against something like 7-Eleven?
I view it much more as a lifestyle brand. So I don't know if our board or others would agree with that, but that's how I've always built it, right? Like, if people love the brand, they'll follow you in different directions, right? Like, we sold zero coffee 5 years ago, and now it's a meaningful part of our business. Same with cafe. We sell a bunch of merch. Private label is now a pretty big part of our business. So, you know, taking all the data and insight that we have on our BI platform, and then we have this, you know, awesome creative team and a great sourcing team, right? So we can say, you know, like a good example isn't wine. So right now, like 5 out of our top 8 wines are all private label. None of them say Foxtrot on them. They're all these other brands that we make up. The quality of the juice for the price is like so much better than what you'd find on the shelf otherwise. But because customers trust, hey, if it's on the shelf, Foxtrot must have vetted it and they must like it, it allows us to do things like that, right? So we can drive a much higher margin on those wines. It's a way better product for the customer, and ultimately you're only gonna be able to get those things at Foxtrot. That's what you can do when you have a lifestyle brand. So to me, like, you know, it's not a convenience store, it's not a delivery service, like it's a brand that can extend itself in different ways.
Let's talk a little bit about, you talk about like being able to have those nice margins. Let's talk a little bit about like the pricing strategy. One of the things like my wife and I will always, and she's here, raise your hand, wife. Woo! Mrs. Hype in the house. So one of the things like, because we frequently will get a push notification that's like, oh, it's snowing, here's $10 off. Like, and we're like, do they just not give a shit about making money? Because like we'll get stuff all the time. It's like free delivery, like free this if you purchase this, $5 off, 15% off. Like, how are you able to operate like with so many of these like different promotions going on at any given time? Give us a little bit of window into the pricing and promotion strategy.
So I might give you a little window into you.
Let's go.
If you are getting all these promotions, it means that you ain't ordering delivery that much. So we've been, I was like completely allergic to sales forever. Like nothing's ever on sale. Pretty allergic to promotions unless there was a really clear like re-engagement payback, right? Because, you know, we were up in this, I mean, this has kind of gone away, but like, especially the last couple years when like there's free money and like, we raised a ton, but like our competitors raised like a like totally crazy amounts. And there was just, everyone's like laden with promo codes. And so our play had to be like, you are coming to us because you want to come to us. Like we cannot play a promo code game because like you're never gonna win. It's a race to the bottom. And so the only time that we use, also the caveat that haven't really been running it for the last 6 months. If you're getting them then, that could be interesting. But our strategy was always, if they've been a good customer in the past, or if they're a really good customer in retail, but they're not using us for the online channels, let's give them a hook to get them online. Because what all of our data, I mean, it's not rocket science, but like our retail customers are worth X, our, you know, online customers are worth Y, but the omni-channel customers were this crazy good cohort, and we knew once we got you to kind of cross the chasm, that's where the magic was. So most of our promo codes, you know, as of whatever, 6 months ago, almost essentially all of them were aimed at getting either retail customers to try delivery, to get delivery customers to go into a store, or vice versa.
You mentioned earlier the struggle with fundraising for so long until it kind of finally hit. If you're not aware at this point, if I have my research right, Foxtrot has raised $194 million in funding. Give that a round.
Too much.
As we come back to sort of that part of the story, what did you kind of feel was like, I guess let me ask it this way. With each round that was coming in or each check that was coming in, were you feeling an added sense of pressure or like a release because now you had a runway?
The series A and B was definitely like released, like, oh my God, I can actually, like, I mean, we literally never had more than 6 months of runway before that, which is a terrible way to run a company, but also like a horrendous way to live. Totally.
Whoa. Siri got activated.
Yeah. So that was much more like, go out there and like do what we want. Like, you know, I felt way more pressure before that Series A came in, because all the money that we had raised was not necessarily friends and family. Like, you know, it's not like we'd had a bunch of rich people around, but someone who was like one step removed, but more like personal people, right? So I'm like, shit, this thing goes under. Like, I know that guy knows, you know, I don't want to lose their money. Like, you know, like I don't want to lose anyone's money. And so there is kind of this nice thing that switches of like, okay, now we've got professional investors on board. Now we actually have a board. This thing is professionalized and we can run it in a much more structured way. So for us, it was this big like relief more so than like pressure. Like we weren't ever, yeah, I would say that.
Yeah. I'm curious about like with this growth.
What is it?
Oh, okay. Yeah, that was happening to me too. Well, the wedding ring hits the mic. That's how you know we're not hiding the wedding ring. With this like sort of progressive growth, and at some point kind of like hyperscaling, it does mean that the things like you love doing, you have to start slowly like letting go of those, or quickly letting go of those reins. Now, at this point, your chairman and a new CEO has been put in, but I want to still talk about when you were still CEO. What were some of the things that, like, maybe from the first few years, you were like, oh, this is, like, my favorite thing, and then you had to let go of that?
That's a good question. I actually tried to really not let go of that stuff. I just worked way too long. So, like, you know, two examples of that. Like, the brand Creative Everything. Like, I can't design anything, but for whatever reason, like I had, you know, had a very, very, very strong perspective on like, it's this, not that. And we were so fortunate that Rob, who's our creative director, who's like the man, we have just such a good partnership, right? So I mean, like every private label product, but like every campaign, every store sign, everything, I never ever let that stuff go, because like if you lose, like I always thought if we lost one of those touch points, like it's gone. Same thing on merch. I mean, up to like a year and a half ago, I wish I kept it longer. Like literally nothing got on the shelf unless it was unless I tasted it, but like unless, you know, it like went through our system, which ended up just becoming like, is someone on the team obsessed with this product, right? And so like, because otherwise it kind of becomes, in our business anyway, it's like too easy to be like, oh, there's this like beautifully branded millennial, you know, nootropic mushroom, whatever it is. And like, it looks cool, but like no one's gonna buy it, right? And so you start adding things that are like, I don't know, some hypothetical yuppie millennial's gonna buy this, but no one likes it. And like, if you do that and people start coming to the store and there's stuff on the shelf that like they buy and they spend their money on and it's like actually not that great, it's the best way to like erode all that trust. So merchandising we kept. And then the like last one that was big for me that, you know, fight's probably too strong of a word, but got in a lot of disagreements with my ops team as I started hiring these operations leaders who had so much more experience than me and knew what they were doing, and I was making it up along the way, was I insisted on being the last interview for every single store manager. Because I'm like, you know, we don't have that many stores, and like, if we don't have amazing store managers, like what else? Like if you walk in the store and have a bad experience, like what else matters? Like everything we're doing here, like it doesn't matter. So you know, what I try to do is like make sure that I had systems in place for those kind of key areas. Cause I'm like, if we're able to keep these things consistent, then, you know, we'll be able to deliver on the customer promise, and then that should take care of the rest.
I really like that.
But I also went totally crazy. So,
but I like that, right? Like you're focusing on, you talked about earlier, the importance of brand. And like you said, it's not just the logo. It's what happens when you open the app. Like what does even the screen look like? How do you feel when you walk in the door? And I think that scrutiny over even just like, I need to talk to every store manager maintains that protection.
And it's who you hire, right? So, I mean, you know, like we had, you know, probably two craziest standards for who we would hire at a, you know, fledgling startup. And, you know, we would do all the technical stuff. We would go through all of it. But then the like last questions are always like, you know, like what was the last show you saw? Like, what's your favorite restaurant? Like, you know, what books are you into right now? And trying to, you know, there was no right answer to those questions, but I wanted them to have answers to those questions, right? Like, I didn't care what you were into, but I wanted you to be into something and be interested in it, right? Because you know, can't do work at a young for us anyway, like this young creative company that was all around merchandising and all around newness, if you know, you yourself weren't actually interested in those things. So we tried really, really hard to set that as a culture for the company.
More on the way in my interview with Mike Lavatola, but in an interview that is about a brand that is so tech-enabled, my question for you is, where are you getting your tech from? Akeva is the goat of software development. Now listen, I've seen too many startups get screwed over by offshore or budget dev shops. You know what those providers are doing? They are doing the bare minimum. And you know why? It's because they're only order takers, which often means you have software with gaping holes, or you're forced to pay hidden release fees to claim ownership of your code. And then there's Akeva, who actually builds strategically for scale from day one, helps you make product decisions, and gives you full ownership of your code by default. And that's whether you're building in AI or machine learning or building an LLM or just building a straight up standard consumer app or anything in between. And they've got a killer offer just for you, the Startup Hype Man community. It's a you call it code review. What's that? Well, for those who qualify, Akeva will review the most critical parts of your code so you can see exactly what your tech needs to launch or scale. And they do this completely free, and then you call it from there. Want to handle things on your own? You call it. Want to get Akeva's dev help? You call it. Want to take it somewhere else? You call it. It's like, remember when you were at the bar and they had $1 or $3 you call it shots, but at the bar it was like Wednesday night and it was only well liquor? Well, this is the opposite of that. This is you call it and you actually have good options in front of you at the end of the day. Ready for your you call it code review? Ready to get goated? Head to akeva.io. That's akeva.io. Akeva.io, or you can tap the link that's in this episode description. And when you get there, tell them Startup Hype Man sent you. Back now to the show.
What was your last show, Mike?
Oh, Jesus. I had twins a year ago, so less shows now. What is my last show? I had to have gotten to something since Windy City Smokeout.
Windy City Smokeout?
Yeah, but that was in the last summer. There's no way that was last
summer. Well, you had twins a year ago, so I mean.
I know. It's all a blur. it'll come back. Don't worry.
With everything that's been put on Foxtrot shelves over the years, what are some of your just like kind of all-time top favorite brands or products?
That's a good question. I've loved learning about wine. So like when I started, like we carried wine, I was like, again, 25, like I don't know anything about wine, drinking beer. I'll give you a real answer, but my cop-out answer is like, so Dylan, who runs our beverage program, who's like just absolutely amazing, getting to like get in the wine world and not like a nerdy, obnoxious way. We did.
Oh no, did it?
Yeah,
no.
We're coming. We can hear you.
Yeah, can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Cool, all right. So anyway, like getting to like dive deep in the wine world has been really fun. It's allowed us to have this big perspective on wine. In terms of brands, like I still love Carol's Cookies. It was the first, I mean, it was on our first menu, it's never left. It's like this grandma up in Highland Park. The cookies are amazing. The packaging, I don't think they've thought about in 35 years. And like, it doesn't matter because it is like fantastic. So I love Carol's.
I think the packaging is what Carol, like it's Carol's packaging.
Dude, Carol's the best. What else has been really, really good? Gemma is probably my new favorite product. So it's this amazing pasta and sauce. It's made right here in Chicago. Chef Tony runs it, but it is like mind-blowingly, like I am completely, completely, completely obsessed with it. So I'd say that for now. Down in Dallas, we have this pretty crazy queso, Sarah Jane's queso. It's currently only sold in Foxtrot and her hairdresser's place. So I'm not like 1,000% sure it's gone through any like, you know, food safety, whatever, but like it's incredible. And so stuff like that's been fun.
Okay, you can hear me, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. Almost a year ago, you stepped down as the CEO,
yep.
And Liz Williams, your CFO, was promoted to CEO. And she's got a really impressive background, like doing senior operations for Taco Bell and Yum Brands. She also was the CEO of Dry Bar, I believe, which is the hair salon, right? Blowout Bar, right, specifically? Yes, okay.
Talk to us about like the emotion behind stepping away as CEO, and then also, you know, with Liz's background and the future of Foxtrot, what's the vision she's kind of now tasked with bringing to life?
Yeah, so a lot of it was that transition that we talked about. So going from this, you know, like tech forward, e-com only, convenience store curator to, you know, now whatever, 70 something percent of our sales are in retail. And of those, you know, almost half of them are in coffee, cafe, prepared food. So long story short, it's essentially now a QSR that's got a really, really big market business and a really big e-com business attached to it. That's a completely different business, right? And given the fact that we've raised this like crazy amount of money, we've got to go open up a lot of stores for them, you know, for our investors to, you know, get to the size and the returns that they need. And so, you know, and also I've been running this thing for like 9 years and essentially went totally crazy by the end, plus had these kids, yada, yada, yada. And so what, it's just a lot. I mean, it was a lot at once. And as I looked at what had to happen next, it was such an operational game, right? Like the brand is in a really good spot. Like I'm obviously still attached to the business. We have amazing merchants. We have amazing designers. Like that culture is there, but we're going to win on operations. Operations are super, super, super hard. And like, I am not the best operator in the world. And so for us, it was like, all right, I can, you know, I kissed a lot of frogs. I found Liz, who is amazing. And it was one of those things, you know, when you look at it objectively, I'm like, well, if the next couple of years is about opening these stores, having them run really, really, really well and driving the P&L, like that's what her skill set is. And we worked really, really, really well together. So it was sort of a no-brainer for me to hand the reins over, take the chairman role, and go from there. And it's been a little less than a year, but it's been working really well.
In a recent Forbes article, she was quoted as saying, "Getting into Foxtrot is like a badge of honor for up-and-coming brands in the CPG world." And that's a lot different than, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 years ago when you had to really convince people that you were worth, you know, them entrusting your brand with. At this point, how is Foxtrot making the decision to say, yes, this brand, not this brand?
That's a loaded question. it is... It's definitely, it's still more art than science, which makes me really, really happy. So whether you stay on the shelf, that's all science, right? Like, are you selling or not? Like, that's the only thing that sort of matters. But getting on the shelf, you know, we're in the fortunate spot now where we get pitched, you know, all the time on new products. People are coming to our stores. People are, you know, we do all these things, right? But I'd say like probably half of the products that we find are at events like this are, you know, whatever, me out in other markets, our merchants out in other markets. And like what we take a huge amount of pride on is finding brands that have never been in retail before. So they're only at farmers markets, right? Or, you know, they like don't have the like packaging, you know, quite right yet, or they don't have whatever quite right yet, but they have total confidence in their product and the product rocks. That's what we want to say yes to, right? Like that is what I want to hold on to for as long as possible. Because if you start putting all this stuff in place, you got to have it packaged in a certain way and get all these certifications and yada, yada, yada. You cut off so many people that are just never going to get into the store. And so you end up with is like a bunch of, you know, people I went to business school with who were awesome, but it's like, you know, they went out for their mushroom nootropic tea and they raised $5 million and they got it beautifully branded. Now it's in the store. There's a place for that. And I love those products. But like the things, I mean, you know, like Carol's cookies or like that queso or like, there's so many brands that are like, we want to be that first retail partner. And the part that I still love about the business and what really gets us going is, you know, there's been so many stories of like, we are the first retailer for a product, like it does well. They then take those sales and they go to Mariano's or they go to Whole Foods, right? And then they get that first big purchase order. And eventually like they end up calling us like, hey, we can't service you anymore because Mariano's buying too much of the stuff. Like that's all good. Like that's awesome. So they got to build their business, and then we get to welcome in whatever that new product is. So I'm sure at some point someone will be yelling at me about like, you know, regulations and food safety and things that are very important if this is on video. But like we want to be the first yes for these up and coming brands for people of all backgrounds to get on the shelf. Because once you're, you know, once you're on the shelf and you have sales data, like that's the great equalizer.
Mm-hmm. So you have, it's as if you kind of get to act now as like a live accelerator, incubator of these brands.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah.
Now, I got to ask this question on behalf of all the showcase startups that are here tonight. Anything that you saw, that you interacted with tonight that you're like, ooh, that could be good on a Foxtrot shelf?
I'm not going to get myself in too much trouble, except for, no, I've had a conversation with like a bunch of you guys, and I'm super easy to find. I'm just Mike at Foxtrot. But like events like these like are how we find like products. I mean, it's like, you know, like this is how it happens. So like, you know, getting on a shelf, our shelf, anyone's shelf, is the same thing as fundraising. It's hard and everyone says no until someone says yes. So you just gotta kinda, you know, that's what entrepreneurship's about, is just being told no 10 times in a row and like showing up the 11th.
By the way, if anyone's ever like, oh, I can't reach out to that person, I don't know their email, it's, you can probably guess it in like three tries. Most people's emails are firstname@firstname.lastname or firstname.lastinitial at, I think even like Mark Cuban's email is like mark@whatever his investment company is.
It is, yeah, it's nuts. I mean, I the first time he, it's like just Mark Cuban at Gmail, like, this is insane, man, come on.
last summer during Tech Chicago Week, which was at the top floor of work, one of the events was at the top floor of this Workbox location. Tom Ricketts, the Cubs owner, was the speaker, and I got like a word with him after, and he was like, oh yeah, send me an email, it's just tom@cubs.com. And I was like, oh, imagine that, tom@cubs.
That's mean they're gonna answer it, but
yeah,
they'll see
exactly,
it.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe that's actually his assistant who operates his inbox, but anyways. So when we started emailing about this event, you were like, hey, like let, you know, I'm free on this day to talk about it. Let's do a Zoom call. And then that day hit, it was like in November, and very casually you're like, hey, would you mind if we bumped our call, our planning call? We had just announced a major merger and I need to attend to that. And I was like, well, I can't believe you asked if I would mind. Of course, of course I would not mind, but you know, it was a big deal that Foxtrot merged with Dom's Kitchen and Market. Raise your hand if you have been to or have heard of Dom's Kitchen and Market. Yeah, pretty much the whole room, great. That's a huge deal. What does this merger mean for the future of both brands now?
Yeah, so, you know, we've known, I mean, when I was at in business school, like, you know, Bob Mariano was like, you know, I was fortunate to get a couple meetings with him, and he's like, he still is, but like, he was like a god at the time, and I'm like, my god, I can't believe he is spending time, you know, talking with me about this. I remember like I went out to stores with him and I got to see a store through his eyes, and like I met all of these people, and so it was this really kind of full circle moment. You know, we have a lot of shared investors. We, you know, sort of both sides have known each other for a while, and so in, you know, it's a deal that came together really fast, like, you know, less than a month fast.
Wow.
And you know, I think in this market, like you have to be really strong, which means you got to get the scale quickly in terms of revenue. You got to get the profitability like yesterday. And you know, combining our two companies, you know, got us to a scale that was really, really interesting, essentially overnight. And when you looked at it, you know, the things that I think that we were really, really good at, I thought we could port over to them. And the things that they were really, really good at, I thought we needed help on. So rather than try to, you know, spend another year or two figuring out doing all the hard work, it was like, why don't we just kind of, you know, get these things together and go forward. So it was really, really helpful that we had that long history beforehand. And I mean, it's only been like a month, or was it January?
Couple,
whatever, 2 months. But you know, I was in the office today, like all the Dom's people are in our office, like everyone's working together, like, it's on, which is really cool.
Nice. I've got two more questions. I'm gonna ask one and then we'll do maximum two audience questions and I'll ask my final one. Knowing everything you know now about building a company, about growing as a person, all of these things, the Mike today, what's one piece of advice you would give to the Mike of 10, 11 years ago?
Oh, that's such a loaded question. I'll answer it two ways. On the fundraising front, I mean, I feel like I really did waste like 4 years trying to convince, do we have like a bunch of Chicago VCs in the room? the same group of VCs to fund us. And like, you know, like I totally believe, you know, you can meet with someone, they can pass, you can come back 6 months or a year later and they'll say yes, right? third, fourth, fifth, seventh, eighth, hundredth time, like it ain't gonna happen. So I think for like a lot of early stage brands, you know, try that route. But ultimately, like if you do need capital, there are you know, a lot of alternate sources of angels who can honestly be like more helpful to your business that can get to yes quicker. And while it might be nice to have a VC on your cap table, it's more important to get capitalized and go. And so I wish I had not wasted so much time trying to convince VCs to fund the business. And then I think the second thing would just be to stick to your guns. Like, you know, everything about starting a company is the reason you're doing it is you have something in your head that is like, I get this thing and I'm going after it. So it's nice to talk to other people. It's nice to get advice. It's nice to talk to folks who are, you know, have been there and done it before. But ultimately, like, you have to trust your gut. Like, that is what is going to get you there. And so, especially when you're starting something, you're young and you haven't, you know, done it before, I think it's kind of scary to trust your gut over someone else who has been there, you know, done it. But ultimately, I think it's the right move.
All right. Audience, who's got a question? Your hand came up first. What's your name and what's your question?
I'm Daniel. I'm CEO right now of a new startup named Peanut Butter. I'm just wondering, what was the biggest game changer for you, and also what was the biggest challenge, and also when do you do your category reviews?
Now that was three questions. So if you get one of them, which one are you picking?
What was the biggest game changer?
Okay, the question is, what was your biggest game changer in running this?
Opening that first store in the West Loop. So, you know, 3 years online only. I just signed a lease. We had a personally guaranteed lease. So we signed this, like, you know, I don't know what they were going to take from us if we didn't have anything. But, you know, so it was a 1,500 square foot store underneath the train tracks, mid block in the West Loop, which was like, there's nothing over there. It was the middle of nowhere. But we had a space and it was ours and it was a store, and like the vibe was right. And it was one of those things where just this is it. Like, why doesn't this exist anywhere? And it was being in that physical space. It felt so different than the online side, which I still love. I mean, I still think our app is amazing, but it was one of those things that was a big eye opener of like, oh, like I think this is actually what we're supposed to be doing. So the biggest moment for sure was getting that store open. It was also the scariest. We had, you know, again, had to sign a lease. Like, how do you even sign a lease? How do you build out a space? How do you get permits? How do you like get a liquor? I mean, you know, it's all a mess, but you figure it out.
Yeah. In Chicago, you can get away with the permitting. Just kidding. Let's go. I'll let you pick the next person's question. Raise your hand if you've got a question.
Yep.
Hi. So my name is Whitney. I have done a lot of marketing, and I work for my own company. I do social media management. A lot of the questions that I get asked from a lot of my clients and help them develop is a niche, and it seems like you've really developed a niche. You've answered quite a bit of questions based on like the background of the brand, but I'm curious how much of your niche was developed based on statistics, like research, and or just like personal branding, like how you actually developed the Foxtrot niche.
The question is, how much of Foxtrot's niche was developed based on the data and the research versus just kind of like branding decisions?
So I don't know if this is the right answer. I would say none of it was based on data or to start, but then it was all based on data once it's live, right? So it's like, a good example, like, what's a good example? Like, you know, why do we sell candles or something, right? Like, because I thought if you're getting a bottle of wine delivered, like people might also want candles. We sell a ton of candles, like a ton of candles. Like, there's no data in the universe that's like, hey, if you have a convenience store, make sure you have like really beautiful $40 candles. At the same time, like, if I carried them and didn't sell, they were gone, right? And so, like, I think so much of like any one of your competitors that's big, like, they're smart. It's not hard to like run pivot tables on existing things that are like are already working and figure out what to sell. So you have to have some personal insight as to what you should be doing. I think that's what you got to follow. But then very quickly, like, you know, the data doesn't lie. So you got to figure out if it's working or not. But like, you know, it's whatever that like specific thing that you see is, like, I would follow that.
Awesome. Thank you.
Great question. Okay, my final question. I'm going to extract the audio from this and push it into my podcast feed. And so every episode of my podcast ends in the same way. Goat to Market Show on all your streams, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all the other platforms too, YouTube. Anyway, so I always ask everyone I have on my show, this question is the last one. Mike, I want you to fill in the blank. Entrepreneurship is blank.
Hard.
It needs no further explanation. The co-founder and now the chairman of Foxtrot, Mike Labatole, everybody.
That was great. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.